Hello, and welcome to Engineers. This is a monthly podcast about all things to do with engineering, and it's coming to you from Northumbria University, Newcastle, in the UK. My name's Nick Martin, I'm sat here with Craig Warren, and this month we're going to discuss lots of interesting things that have been going on in engineering for the past month or so. So we're going to talk about some interesting engineering facts that we've got. We're going to talk about some news items, in one in particular on plastic bergs that have been found in Indonesia. And we're also going to talk about an engineering article this month on cascading power limits. So we'll kick things off with a bit of an introduction from us, since this is our kind of pilot episode. So Craig, who are you? What do you do?
Hey Nick, well, it's a pleasure to be part of this podcast. I am a Vice Chancellor's Senior Fellow in Future Engineering here at Northumbria University. And it's a bit of a fancy title really, but basically what it means is that I carry out quite a lot of research. I also do some teaching. And I'm part of this future engineering multidisciplinary research theme here. And that's basically one of, I think, 8 or 9 NDRTs here at the university that were created basically to address the fact that a lot of the problems that we're trying to solve these days are very much cross-disciplinary in nature. So that's my role here. So my research interests are in the area of infrastructure sensing. And that's an interesting area to be working in because we have a lot of large pieces of important infrastructure in the UK that have been around for a long time, and trying to understand their behaviour to detect faults and such like in them is a really important problem. So part of what I do is work on developing different sensors and imaging techniques to assess these pieces of infrastructure. And I also do some work at looking on how we can kind of integrate these sensors into buildings that we're creating for the future. So I do a lot of work with geophysicists, with electronic engineers, and also computer scientists here. So that's why it's really great to be part of this multidisciplinary research team.
Do you mind if I ask, what made you want to become an engineer?
That is a good question, and I had to think back more years than I care to remember now. But one of my kind of passions outside of work is motorsport and cars. So I'm really a bit of a petrol head at heart, you could say. And it was really that originally kind of got me into engineering. I started kind of, you know, tinkering with cars and taking engines apart and trying to figure out, you know, how they worked. And that kind of sparked my interest and sent me down this path.
That's interesting. So that's similar to my kind of entry into engineering, I suppose. When I was 16, my parents bought me a completely banged up Volkswagen camper van. Engine didn't work. And that was my first kind of introduction to doing some engineering, kind of getting that fixed up. And yeah, from there, I mean, obviously enjoying maths and physics at college and at school was kind of prompted me to do that as well. But yeah, that was kind of my route in. As I said, my name's Nick. So I'm also at Northumbria University. I'm a senior lecturer and I'm based in the Department of Mechanical and Construction Engineering. Automotive engineering is one of our newer degree programs. And so yeah, my research is quite closely linked with that, but predominantly on the aerodynamics side. So before I started at Northumbria, I worked for Williams Formula One team for 5 years or so in their aerodynamics department. And so my research is kind of very much aligned with aerodynamics and fluid mechanics and that side of things. So in this part of the show, we're going to talk about a couple of facts, interesting facts that we found that are loosely related to engineering. So in no particular order, we'll kick off with my fact this week, which is that the famous Victorian British engineer
and civil engineer
Isambard Kingdom Brunel almost died trying to do a magic trick.
Yeah, amazingly, of all the things we know Brunel for, magic was not the first one that kind of jumped to mind.
There's probably a good reason for that, because I don't think he was very good at it.
Please explain, Nick.
So, he was trying to do a magic trick for his children. It was like one of these conjuring magic tricks where you've got like a coin. I think at the time it was a half penny. He was trying to basically do kind of a conjuring trick with this, and he managed to get it lodged in his throat. very nearly killed him. So he tried various methods for extracting this coin from his throat. So he had some specially made kind of, I want to use the term forceps. I don't know if that's really the right term to use, which didn't work. He came up with his own invention to try and shake the coin free. So maybe he is a better civil engineer than he is a mechanical engineer.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because when I was looking up, you know, some facts on Brunel, I came across a phrase that said, among all the amazing pieces of infrastructure that he created, he wasn't always successful with his design solutions, but despite the fact that he often managed to solve a lot of long-standing problems, so perhaps this was a case needed to improve his design somewhat.
Yep, so well, his own invention didn't work very well, but there was, I can't remember who it was who came up with the actual thing that cured it, but it was basically like a torture device. And they put him upside down and tied him to this kind of thing that basically shaked around backs and forwards, and that eventually kind of dislodged the coin.
And allowed him to continue...
engineering.
Indeed. Amazing.
So, I mean, it is quite impressive, the kind of range of things that he kind of worked on in his life. So he's famous for bridges. So there's the Clifton Suspension Bridge.
Yeah, I think that's probably the one that lots of us kind of know. It's a very iconic bridge near Bristol, isn't it?
Which wasn't actually finished construction until 10 years after he passed away. But he still claims credit for it. Although there is some kind of... conspiracy theorists who would say that
really? He
didn't kind of come up with the design originally, but we're not into fake news here on this podcast, so we don't want to
avoid that. Yes.
and actually, the magic trick that almost killed him wasn't the only time he almost died. He started off working for his father, who was also an engineer, and so he was involved with building the is it the Thames Tunnel in London?
Yes, that's right.
The Victorian Tunnel there.
Yeah.
And there was a collapse in 1827 when he was working there, which almost killed him. So he's
diced with death on several occasions in his his career. Yeah. Wow.
And he was also well known for wearing quite a high top hat. Okay, so moving on, next up we've got Craig with his fact.
Well, yeah, I somehow feel my fact is lacking intrigue, given what we've just talked about, but it's something that kind of I came across a few days ago that interested me quite a lot, and my fact is that a typical individual's Google use for an entire year would produce about the same amount of CO2 as a single load of washing.
That is quite incredible when you kind of think about, because you don't often associate, I don't think, the use of something like Google, like, you know, the internet, with energy consumption. You know, when you hit search or Google, you don't necessarily consider that to be something that would necessarily use energy. But obviously you're transmitting information down wires, which is, you know, which requires some energy input.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I read it. I thought, wow, I've never really thought about the energy I'm using when I'm Googling all these obviously very relevant pieces of information. And I certainly hadn't, I'd never considered the CO2 that was being used when I was doing a single load of washing either. So I had no real idea about how to compare that. But this actually came out of a piece of research that was done almost 10 years ago now. So I guess these figures may have changed slightly since then, hopefully for the better, given the sort of drive for more efficient computing and you know, renewable energy powered data centers and such like. But Google said at the time that they calculated that actually the machine that you're sitting at to make your search from will use more energy than actually the energy required to do the search and send the results back.
That is really interesting. And
I think it's quite relevant given that, you know, a lot of the computing that we're starting to do now is very much kind of cloud based and, you know, happening in these massive data centers. So I guess it feeds into understanding the amount of energy that these things are consuming.
So I mean, just on washing machines and energy efficiency, I don't know why, but I read this the other day that front loading washing machines, as opposed to, you know, the kind of more commonly used in America, top loaders, are 30 to 50% more efficient.
Top loaders are
30. No, front loaders are
more efficient. Okay.
I don't understand why that would be the case.
Interesting, yeah, because I guess the dynamics are slightly different.
Yeah, the dynamics would be slightly different, but you'd think, if anything, that spinning around the, well, I'm going to say the z-axis. That doesn't really mean anything on a podcast.
Yeah,
but the vertical axis.
The vertical axis.
Yeah, that's probably. I'm not sure why that would necessarily.
That's an interesting thing for us to look into, perhaps.
If any interesting, or anyone clever who designs washing machines who's listening to this could tell us, then get in contact, because I want to know why that is. Did you know that Google owns their own misspellings of the name Google? So, like, if people misspell it with, like, an extra O or miss out the E or something, like, why you do that, I don't know, then Google still owns copyrights to most of those kind of differentiations on the spelling of the word Google.
Interesting. I've certainly seen before a lot of kind of big internet companies that buy, you know, domain names that are misspelling of, you know, of their products to make sure that everyone still gets directed to the right place. But I've never heard of like somebody owning the copyright to a misspelling of their name.
So this month's news article is it's a news article from the BBC, and obviously we'll put links to the news article in the show description notes. And you can find links on our website as well. All the details will come at the end of the show. But it's on a news article. The title is that a giant plastic berg, I'm kind of doing quotation marks, blocks Indonesian river. And so basically it's about a giant kind of gathering of plastic, which the BBC has dubbed a plastic berg. And the article goes on to explain how this kind of massive kind of gathering of plastic basically blocked a river, and the army had to be called in to kind of help deal with it and to remove all the plastic. And so, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of kind of tie-in here to what we do as engineers, because obviously, as you're as an engineer, you're going to be, you know, designing and developing products, and at the moment, quite a lot of those products are made from plastics. And you know, there's been quite a lot of press recently about plastics and, you know, how potentially harmful they can be to the environment. If anyone saw the Blue Planet 2 documentary, there was quite a lot of, well, they had a whole episode actually talking about these issues.
I mean, that's what I was remembering when I saw these images in this article of the all the plastics choking the river. It brought back that image of the ocean, really. I think the interesting thing about this is that I think because it's on people's doorsteps, perhaps there's been more consideration of how to address it.
Mm.
But it does kind of present a series of challenges, both, you know, the engineering side of things and the kind of cultural side of things as well, in terms of educating people on, you know, how we should dispose of plastics, how we should think about, you know, I guess reusing them in the first place.
Yeah. You know, and if you're studying engineering, if you're an engineering undergraduate, you'll learn about, you know, what this means when you're studying material science. And what you'll learn is that, you know, these carbon-carbon bonds that basically kind of make these strand-like structures, they're incredibly hard to break. And so even if through heating or, you know, tensile force, you manage to break some plastic apart, you're not really breaking down the actual bonds that kind of hold the plastic, or make the plastic what it is. And so the plastic just kind of gets smaller and smaller and smaller, but it never stops being plastic. And so as it gets smaller, you know, animals can potentially eat it. And, you know, that's how it kind of gets into the ecosystem and why really it's such a kind of potential problem. I guess because of that, whilst that's a drawback in potentially in terms of plastics, it's also what makes them such a great universal material for building lots of things and making lots of different things. And so as engineers, you know, it's a go-to material when you want to try and make things, particularly in more recently in terms of 3D printing and rapid prototyping, and you know, maybe we'll talk a bit about that as well.
So yeah, kind of coming back to the news article, I guess a lot of the plastic we're talking about here is from the food industry, in terms of the packaging that's used to, you know, contain your tomatoes or whatever you buy at the supermarket, and a lot of plastic water bottles, because it's very attractive in that industry because it's a very hygienic material, it's easy to produce, and that's presumably, you know, why we're seeing so much of it clogging up these rivers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a growing problem at the moment. So in the last 10 years, we've produced more plastic than we have in the whole of the last century. So, you know, we're using and consuming plastic at a growing rate. And, you know, I think that's a real, real issue that engineers need to think about in terms of when you're designing things and, you know, whether you're going into the food industry and engineering products for packaging food, or whether you're, you know, making other forms of, doing other kinds of engineering that involve plastics, you know, thinking about those kind of things, I think, it's something that's important. And, and it is something that we teach our engineers when they're doing their undergraduate degrees, but, you know, maybe we even need more emphasis on this kind of thing and the different approaches you can take.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it feeds into sort of thinking about the life cycle of the product that you're developing and what happens to the materials that are in that product when it reaches the end of its useful life.
Yeah, exactly. So not just, you know, it's not just about can we make plastics, more recyclable or biodegradable, but also, you know, if you can, even if a plastic isn't necessarily recyclable, if you can create a product which has a life cycle which allows it to be reused in some way, then that's almost just as good as as, you know, the more material science approach of producing, say, biodegradable plastics, for example.
Yeah. I think what interested me about this article is that, you know, we're talking about a developing country here, but the plastic problem obviously is a worldwide problem, and we're still trying to get to grips with it, even in the UK. A statistic that I came across to kind of highlight how different countries are doing better or worse at dealing with the problem. In Norway at the moment, 95% of all plastic bottles are currently recycled, and that figure in England is only 57%. So, and it feeds into some information that I think we heard in the news a few weeks ago, which was kind of the government talking about different models for recycling specifically plastic bottles.
Mm.
And perhaps trying to adopt this, you know, the German scheme of paying a deposit for your bottle,
yeah,
to encourage you to, you know, to take it back and recycle it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know the exact figures, but I know that Germany is one of the many countries which is ahead of the curve, and certainly ahead of the UK in terms of plastic recycling. And yeah, I mean, I do think it's something that, you know, just generally that people can do in their day-to-day lives in terms of recycling. But I mean, it also has to be something that I think government does in terms of, you know, promoting, making it easier basically to recycle things, making sure that, you know, because I don't know if you get this, but like when you're recycling a plastic bottle, you're like, should I leave the lid on? Or like, is the lid recyclable? And what, you know, and all of,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there are still a lot of kind of unknowns, even when you get to the point of deciding that you should recycle it.
Yeah.
I certainly know that, you know, kind of even just choosing what recycling bin it should go into can sometimes be a bit of a task.
Yeah, and so I think the other point, kind of we briefly mentioned it earlier about rapid prototyping, and you know, 3D printing is something that comes under that umbrella, and 3D printing is at the moment predominantly plastic based.
Mm.
And there's, you know, there's good reasons for that. In general, plastics kind of have the properties that you can, you know, you can melt them so that they can be printed quite easily, but then they form, you know, reasonably solid structures. And so, you know, they're almost ideal for 3D printers.
Yeah, it's really something that's become, you know, much more popular and accessible on a much wider scale. So
yeah, I mean, here at Northumbria, you know, any undergraduate student in the Faculty for Engineering and Environment has full access to about 20 or so 3D printers. They can just come along with a USB stick and use them as they like. So that's, you know, whilst that's really great, and it's great for undergraduates to just kind of do that, I don't know if it does, you know, take away a little bit from, you know, making sure that students are aware of the kind of environmental impacts that they're having when they're doing these kind of things and printing these bits of plastic.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, certainly.
Well, I mean, if any of you listening have any opinions on this and want to get in touch, then yeah, we'll give all the details at the end of the show. Okay, so in this part of the show, we're going to talk about an interesting research article that we came across this month. So the actual name of the article is The Principles of Cascading Power Limits in Small, Fast, Biological and Engineered Systems. That appeared in Journal Science. We'll put links to the... But just to kind of go over basically what this is, what they're talking about in this article, it's all about the differences between kind of motor action or motor-driven action and spring-driven action. And so to give you a kind of simple example, if you think about the difference between, say, someone launching a shot put and someone firing a bow and arrow. So a bow and arrow is an example of a spring-driven action, and a shot put would be an example of a motor-driven action. So In the shot put sense, then you're kind of using your arm muscles to drive the shot put and launch it, whereas with the bow and arrow, you're still using your muscles to kind of apply a force to the spring or the bow, which acts as a spring, and then you're using your fingers as a latch to kind of hold that force or hold the bow in tension, and then you can then release your fingers, which is the kind of latch system, to allow the arrow to be fired. But then at that point, the kind of force velocity product, which is produced, you know, to actually launch the arrow or the projectile, is then purely driven by the spring action and rather than the motor action.
And that's one of the kind of key things that they're trying to sort of investigate and model here, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, it seems like quite a fundamental study, you know, potentially something that's been, you know, you'd think that maybe this is something that's been known about before, but I suppose the new element in the research is that they've produced this kind of relatively simple model to describe those two actions, and then looked across lots of different scales in terms of the mass of the projectile to see, you know, where there's a kind of, at what point does it become better or more efficient to use a motor-driven system as compared to, say, a spring-driven system. You know, which is really important when you're designing an engineering product, because depending on how heavy it is, the thing that you're trying to move, and the speeds at which you want to try and move that thing, then you're going to get different potential approaches.
And they've looked for kind of applications of this in biology and kind of examples of these different actions that exist in biology, and tried to kind of use their conclusions to characterize some of these examples as well.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, at the smaller end of the scale, in biology, for example, you've got things like the mantis shrimp. So at the smaller end of the scale, that's where spring-driven action is kind of much more efficient than motor-driven action. Yeah, so as an example of this, the kind of smaller end of the scale, where you've got things like a mantis shrimp's arm, when it kind of snaps its claws shut, that's a spring-driven mechanism, so they have a kind of, I don't know, some kind of part of their arm which has a latch, and then they're able to extremely rapidly move their arm, I don't know if arm is the right word, but move their arm out and shut their claws, and that happens extremely quickly and causes an effect called cavitation, which is where in a fluid you can have basically bubbles kind of forming, and in some cases that can also cause something called sonoluminescence, which is where when the bubbles collapse they produce light. So anyway, that's kind of one end of the scale, and at the other end of the scale you've got you know, heavier animals, so things like frogs, for example. So when a frog jumps, that's predominantly a motor driven action, so you know, more equivalent to the shot put.
That's the contraction of the muscles, obviously, and then the release that generates the motion.
So there's this kind of crossover point that they talk about, or that they depict in one of their figures, which is kind of the crossover point for the where, you know, a spring-driven system becomes more efficient than a motor-driven system. So that's about, is it 5 grams that they decide is that kind of crossover point. So if you're the thing that you're trying to move, essentially.
So if it's less than 5 grams, then you should consider a spring-driven system.
Exactly. Okay. That's what they're saying, basically. So the maximum power achieved is greater for a spring-driven system.
I think it's really interesting the fact that, you know, they've kind of obviously crossed over between engineering and biology, and in general, you know, when we're thinking about some of our engineering designs and systems, sort of drawing inspiration from biology is clearly, and perhaps some lessons from there as well, it's clearly something we can consider.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we do or try to do quite a lot in aerodynamics as well, looking at kind of bird flight and, you know, shark skin and all of this kind of stuff that you hear about, where from in aerodynamics, where things are derived from nature. I mean, this is a similar kind of thing that they're kind of talking about in terms of what they call synthetic systems. So that's kind of engineered systems which are based upon you know, potentially based upon biomechanical kind of systems.
And I guess often the challenge for us as engineers is to try and understand what's going on in nature in the first place, so that we can actually use some of that behavior.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what this article really highlights, that, you know, whilst we might think, well, whilst this you know, seems like something that's, you know, relatively fundamental, I think being able to characterize it and describe it over multiple scales is actually really important. And like you said, it allows us to be able to kind of decide when we're designing synthetic systems what's the best approach, basically. Okay, that's all we've got time for in this episode of Engineerds. If you'd like to get in touch and talk to us about any of the things that we've said during this podcast, then you can do so via our Twitter handles. I'm on at MD Martin Craig.
And I'm at Dr. Craig Warren.
Or you can email us at engineers.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at engineersuk. You can find all the previous episodes, which there aren't any of them in because this is our first episode, on our website, engineers.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.